You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Patti LaBelle is known as the godmother of soul, and for good reason. The Southwest Philly-born singer has had an incredible career, with highlights including girl group hits of the early 60s. Crossover success in the 70s. Lady Mama, and a show-stopping performance at Live Aid Philly in 1985. She joined me in 1996 on a book tour to discuss her autobiography, Don't Block the Blessings, Revelations of a Lifetime. Later in the hour, we'll also hear my 2013 interview with Kevin Eubanks, another Philly-born musician famous for leading the Tonight Show band with Jay Leno. But most of the hour is with Patti, who starts here talking about what prompted her to write the book.
Why did you want to tell people that know you but don't know you about your private life?
Well, it wasn't anything that I planned, that's for sure. I have been asked to do a book for many, many years, and I would always say no. The reason I said no is because I thought that my life was pretty boring offstage and that I wouldn't have anything that was that interesting for people to want to read. And I kept being asked and kept being asked, and finally the last time I said to my husband, I said, why do they keep asking me to write a book? He said, evidently somebody thinks you have something to say. So I said, okay. I said, first I got permission from him. I said,
from your husband?
Yeah, from my husband. I said, because if I'm going to write a book, it's going to be a real book. And it's going to be nothing for sensationalism, nothing to sell books, but very, very honest. And some of the things that I might go back to might embarrass you. So he said, of course I won't be embarrassed of anything that you were, because it made you what you are today. Mm-hmm. And so I got his permission and my kid's permission, and I said okay, and I found Laura Randolph, who I didn't find, who's been a friend for a long time, who's written so many things for me in Ebony Magazine, and she's a person who can write the way I speak. And so we started, and I, after starting the book, I realized that I had been holding and hiding so many things for years and afraid of telling people any of the things that I had gone through. And after talking to her, I realized, I said, what makes her so special that I can talk to her and tell her all of my secrets? And it just ended up being like I was talking to a shrink. And so, it's very cathartic.
So you even surprised your own self?
I mean,
that there were things that you hadn't thought about for many years?
Things that I had suppressed, things that I had blocked. And I didn't want to think about them ever again. But in writing the book, she was letting me know that, of course, when you do this, you know, you think, Patti, she said, but anything you give me, if you don't want it in the book after it's done, we don't have to include it. So I had that protection. But after it was done, I wanted everything out. I wanted everything in the book because it was cleansing to me. It was like I had dusted off my soul finally.
Well, it almost appears as if there are two Patti LaBelles. There's the Patti LaBelle that everybody knows from the stage.
Uh-huh.
And then there is a very private Patti LaBelle,
yes.
One who goes home and you know, slumps around in fuzzy slippers,
uh-huh, that's
and sweatpants, and lives a very quiet, quote-unquote, normal
life. Yeah, that's the one that's the one I prefer, that quiet, laid-back girl, because with that one, I find rest. With the other one, it's like, you know, it comes with the territory. If you're going to be a performer, you're going to have to be very outgoing. You're going to have to be on all the time. And this is what I am. It's not pretense, but when I'm performing and when I'm doing stuff like this, I know that you have to do it a certain way or don't do it at all. But offstage, this doesn't come out at all with me. I'm just very quiet and laid back. On stage, the lights come on, and here comes that fool.
Well,
she's out.
I don't know how foolish
she is.
She's
crazy. I'm serious, Marty. I'm crazy on stage.
But you know, it's interesting too that reading through your book, you quote, this is from you. You describe yourself as a homely little child, very shy little girl. I got some background on you, and according to your mother, she had to pay you to go outside and play.
It was bad.
Why do you think you were so shy?
I was afraid of people. I didn't like people. Not that I didn't like people. I didn't like to be around people because that meant conversation. And why should I have to talk?
You didn't want to talk?
I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to talk to
people. You felt like you didn't have anything to say?
That I didn't have anything of interest to say. And so my friends were cats, dogs, butterflies. They couldn't talk back.
You talked to them?
I talked to them. I was a little special. The only thing the dog did for me is when I was singing in the mirror one day, he gave me the bark of approval and said, "You're good." And he just barked me on, and I continued to sing after that. But I never liked to be around people. And I was under my mother's apron. She would say, "Let me give you a quarter. Just go outside and sit on the steps." And I would go out and sit on the steps, and I know she was hoping a friend would come by and maybe I would make a friend. But I never did. And so the closest thing that I got to making a friend was when I joined the choir and met people then, and that's when I started singing.
Where do you think you got your voice? You said that your father had a good singing voice. Do you think it came from him?
It came from my father, and what I understand, my great-great-grandmother. I heard she had a beautiful voice, but my father had a wonderful voice. So I got my voice from him.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What'd you sing in the mirror?
I don't remember. Anything, I guess. I mean, I have no clue. The mirror and the broom was the mic.
Right.
And I don't know what I was singing. It could have been, I know what it was, because I listened to Gloria Lynn, Dakota Staton, James Moody, and Nina Simone, and I was singing Porgy. I love you, Porgy. That's what I was singing.
And
let him take me. I love that song. That's what I was singing, because those are the songs that my brother listened to. And so I will listen to his music.
So when you were home alone with the broomstick and the mirror, you had courage. You could sing. You felt like
and I could express anything alone. It was in front of people that I had the problem.
Well, you joined this choir.
I joined the choir. And, of course, we had a big audience on Sunday. And we had Tuesday rehearsals. And my choir director, Miss Chapman, would push me a lot. And one day there was a song to be done, and they needed a solo. They needed someone to sing the solo, to do the lead. And, of course, I raised my hand. Not of course. It was so unlike Patsy Holt. But I raised my hand, and the choir members laughed, I think, because they said, "She's not going to sing lead." And so I said to Miss Chapman, "I definitely want to do this." And so she looked at me, and she said, "Well, Patsy, if you think you can, I know you can." She was very positive. And so I sang that day.
Well, no, why do you think you had the courage to do that? As you said,
because
you were terrified.
She was so nice. She was so comforting. And she was my comfort level. Like, if I did fail after trying, I knew that she would make me feel as though I just did the best thing in the world by just opening my mouth. So I wasn't afraid of failure with her. And I also had a school teacher the same way, Mr. Briskin, who forced me to sing in the chorus in school. And then he found that I had a group, and he got our group booked at a club here in South Philly called the Venus Lounge. And the Italians turned on me. It was this Italian club. And I was shy that night, and I wasn't putting out what he knew I could. So he was saying to the owner of the club, "Just give her another chance. Give the group another chance." So the next night we came back, and I learned in that one day, come back to Sorrento. And I went back and sang that song, honey, and killed the children. So after that, I had courage because I had sung in front of these Italian children. They could have turned on me and got me good, but they didn't.
Now, when did you think you had a good voice? I mean, obviously, there were teachers, people who along the way who wanted you to sing. They recognized what you had.
When did I think I had a good voice? Mm-hmm. When I sang God Specializes in the choir. That's when I realized I was okay.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, meaning kind of good. You know, not. I can never pat myself on the back. I can never say, "Oh, you sound fierce, girl." I don't go there with myself. Some people do say things like that to me, and I shy away from the compliments usually. But I was pretty good in the choir.
How much formal training then have you had over the years?
I have not, but I am going to. I'm going to get a vocal coach.
Now, after how many?
52,
I'm going to get the age of 52. Patti LaBelle's getting a vocal coach.
Because there's
about
some
time,
things
right?
that I could learn. Possibly ways to sing much, much better and hold. I can hold notes. The older I get, the longer I can hold a note now. But maybe with training, I could even hold it longer. Mm. I mean, you just look at the opera singers, Pavarotti and all those wonderful strong voices. I don't know how old he is, but Lord knows the power that he has. I mean, I think I could get some more power going.
That would be extraordinary.
Out there, right? There's somebody who can possibly show me a little trick or something. So I plan to do vocal coaching and drama. I want to learn how to act.
Right. Well, I know also, you've acted in movies and in plays in the past.
Yeah, but it was awful.
You didn't care for it?
No, not. I mean, I could look at myself on some of the sitcoms that I've done, like A Different World and then the one that I had Out All Night. I was so pitiful. I just laughed at myself sometimes. I said, girlfriend, you're just getting over. You're not that good. So I have to do some drama coaching stuff. I have to be taught that.
Let me ask you how you think your voice has changed. As you said, you feel like you can hold a note longer now in your 50s. How else has your voice developed and changed over the years?
It's more mellow, I think. Today, it's awful. I can't sing at all. I'm hoarse today. And that's because of the book tour and everybody in line, I'll talk to them. So I've lost my voice from talking, not singing. But I notice, like I said, the older I get, the longer I hold a note. And I think it's the clarity. I think it's better. I think so, yeah. And I enunciate much better with age. Much better, I believe.
Do you do anything special to take care of your voice? I mean, you're going to rest and you're on a book tour, so you've been talking.
Yeah,
but are
I
there
do
certain
specials.
Things you do?
Marty, can I take off these earrings?
Yeah. I always take off my earrings.
Yeah, I see yours on the table.
You
I
can just
taken
keep talking,
these off.
Though.
But what I do is I turn my shower on at home or in the hotels and let the steam go and let the bathroom get totally full of steam and sit in there for like a half an hour and inhale the steam. And I also drink hot tea with honey, lemon, and spirit of peppermint, this real strong stuff that you only need a drop of in your tea. And it opens, well, psychologically it works for me or whatever, but I think it works. And
that's it.
Echinacea. Mm-hmm. I can't say it, but that's what it's a natural herb, and it's a drop I take. And I take that, and it just makes me think that I'm getting better vocally. I just take those things, and that's it. And I sleep as much as I can. You know, when you're hoarse, you try to do total vocal rest, like no talking, and you can write notes. That's what you should do. I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the main thing that would save me. But I run my mouth so much. I never stop talking.
Well, I hope you run your mouth for the next 40 minutes.
I promise
you. That's Patti LaBelle, our guest today on Radio Times. Let me ask you about something that Jerry Goffin said. This was back in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
A quote, in the 60s, God was a young black girl who could sing. Did you feel that you were part of, and I'm thinking of the girl groups back in the 60s, mm-hmm. but did you think you were part of a, I don't know, a phenomenon going on back in the 60s with the girl groups, the Supremes, and other groups as well?
Well, there were so many girl groups, and I was just a part of the entourage, I mean, of the girl groups. Right. And to me, I felt as though there was a lot of competition, like everybody was trying to outdo everybody. I was just trying to put on my little matching dress of the other three ladies and going out there singing as hard as I could because God had given me something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful experience being on the shows with a lot of girl groups and being in that era. I mean, it was just, you don't have that anymore mm-hmm. with girl groups. That was a special, special time that I will remember as a positive time in my life.
Well, and Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, you had a hit song called I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you were part of this group?
I don't know.
Were you still a teenager?
I can't remember many things, Marty. I was a teenager, maybe 17, maybe. I don't have a clue. It was a long time ago.
You remember what you wore?
Mm-hmm. We wore matching dresses. Looked like we got them from Woolworths. I don't know where those dresses came from. High heels, ankle bracelets, white gloves, tiaras, and probably a necklace and a bracelet. Anything that looked like Hoochie Mama, we did. And hats. We had hats on if we didn't have the tiaras on. I remember that. Just dressing. We had too many things on. Too many things.
And you performed, I know, on American Bandstand. I mean, Philadelphia was
one of the
places to be.
And that's when we wear those little Bluebell bell bottoms with stripes, the sailors looking like four fools. But back in the day, we looked cute because that was the style. You know, but you look at some of these pictures and you say, did I do that?
Mm.
And I always look at my pictures and say, I had and I still do have a great sense of humor. looking at some of the stuff I did.
Well, I would assume in your business, a great sense of humor can help you through some really rough spots.
It does. I mean, it's like even this week, for the last month, it's been the hardest month I've ever had in my life doing this book tour. I never knew people could work this hard. And so for Comic Relief, we just start picking at anything in the car or anything, we start picking at each other and just doing stupid stuff just for comic relief. And we just start laughing. And people who are coming into our little circle, they're saying, well, what are you guys laughing at? I said, you wouldn't understand. You have to have worked for a month with no days off like we have from morning until the next morning to understand where we're coming from. Nobody understands the sense of humor, but you have to have it in this business, because if you looked at everything and if you felt sad and moanful about all the hard stuff that you have to do, although the hard stuff that you have to do is a blessing, because the alternative, you know, is not to be doing anything at all. And I'm definitely happy and thank God again for all this work. So I just work as hard as I can when I can, because I know if I don't do it, there's somebody waiting in the wings with more talent than I have who will take my place. So I never let up. I never let up.
Well, I'm curious, even when you were getting started and you had several groups that you were in, how much did you know about the recording industry? I mean, here you were cutting
nothing.
Records and going out on tour and performing. Mm-hmm. And
that wasn't important to me at the time. When we started singing, we only wanted to be on a show with anybody. We only wanted to get paid anything they paid us, because we didn't care. We didn't know. We had nothing to compare it to. So the biggest thing to us was getting these little outfits and feeling like we were like big girls with new clothes. And the business meant nothing. The money, like I said, we made maybe $10 a week.
Is that right?
I mean, it was very little, because I don't know if we were taken advantage of or what, or is that what we were being paid at the time? I don't remember all the details of that time. My mother and father would say, "Sugar, you're being used." And I would laugh at them. I said, "How? Used how?" I said, "I'm doing what I want to do." But they knew that there was a business side of it that I was totally ignoring. But I was pleased to ignore it. It was fine with me, because the next thing I knew I was going to do was sing.
There must have been some point in your career when you said, well, first of all, this is a career and I've got to take care of myself.
I said that.
And looking around and seeing how other people were doing and thinking, well, I got to get a piece of this myself.
Oh, sure. That happened. That happened after the Bluebells. And when we became LaBelle. And, of course, I was with a husband at that time who was very, very, very much into the business side of everything and would manage me periodically. And then I would get another manager. But I can say now for the last 10 years or more than that, he's been my manager. And sometimes you say, well, you get so close to home and you get so this, and your husband might take advantage of you. They think of Ike and Tina Turner or something crazy. My husband's not that kind of guy. I've been very blessed and been married for 27 years, been with him for 30 years, to have a very decent man who's not Mr. LaBelle, who doesn't want to shine in my light, and who doesn't want to take my money because he has his own. And I'm very, very blessed and lucky.
And for those people that haven't kept up with all the chapters in your life,
oh, so many.
the whole LaBelle chapter was really, wild theatrics,
yeah.
Wild costumes. Where did you get that look? I mean, perhaps you could even describe it for the listeners.
Okay, I can describe the look. The look was now no dressing alike. Nobody dresses the same. Everybody has an outfit that's appropriate for their body style. Nona had the body, and still does, the body of death, the body of life. I mean, she has a beautiful body, and she showed it off.
Long and lanky.
Long and lanky, a size 2 waist, a size 50 bust, and hips to match, and everything, and a beautiful face. And so she wore things that revealed her little stomach and her boobs. And Sarah had another beautiful body, a shorter version. And I was just bubbling on in the middle somewhere with the body of whatever. And so I wore things that wouldn't cling, you know. And then every now and then I would wear a cat suit. But we wore a lot of silver cables.
Yeah.
Sarah wore silver breastplates. Gold breastplates were silver. We wore feathers.
Wild hair.
Wore wild hair. High platform shoes. And we looked like nobody else. And we were the first black women, or the first women, period, to do what we did. And I was so happy about our look at that time. And it was something after seeing us, Kiss decided to go to our guy who made our stuff, Larry Legaspi. And I think the Funkadelics, I think they followed.
But this was a look you got when you went over to England, right? We went to perform in England. And
actually, we went to London to regroup. We were going to go there and become from the Bluebells with the matching dresses to the Outrageous LaBelle. And we were there for a long time fighting. I fought them like crazy, saying that I wasn't going to change. I'm not going to go out there and take a chance and lose our fans by coming back with this rock music and with these outrageous clothes. I'm not doing it. So after talking to them for a few months, and I said, okay, the best thing I can do is go along. Mm-hmm. And we came back to the States, and we did our first show, and the people went crazy because they were looking for change also. And I realized I was wrong in that, by thinking that we shouldn't change. I was so happy that we did after the fact.
Well, did you change? I mean, did these costumes give you a kind of courage, whatever, to go out there and really
and become sassy and cut loose? The costumes did that for us. The whole attitude of LaBelle did that. I mean, because we were not singing ballads anymore. We were singing songs like The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, We Won't Be Fooled Again, all those songs that I loved, and Wild Horses, The Stones. I mean, we were doing stuff, Gil Scott-Heron. We were just singing songs that black women didn't sing. We were singing sexual songs. We were singing any kind of song that you would not expect us to sing. And it all was a way of me growing up. No more little cutesy little prissy miss thing. Just all out rock or whatever.
Did you ever have, in all the spectacle, have things fall down? Or I know you used to come in on a wire. I mean, make an entrance, an aerial entrance. I mean, did you ever get hung up on
those
wires?
I got stuck in my cage. We used to have, it was a Wear Something Silver event at the Metropolitan Opera House, which was a very big step in my life.
And you were the first black group
to play the Met.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the first rock and roll group to play the Met. And this was an event. Everybody wore something silver, and we had the props of life. And Sarah made her entrance. Nona made her entrance on ground. Miss Patty, crazy girl, had to come in flying like Batgirl. So they had me in a cage, and I was flying down. Night birds fly by the light of the moon. And I was coming down, and my arms were flopping inside the cage, and I was trying to get myself together to get on the ground. And when I got down to the ground, I couldn't get out. And so I was saying, but I'm stuck, and I can't get out. And they thought it was a part of the song. And the audience, they were like cheering and making so much noise. They didn't hear me say that I was stuck. The audience didn't care because they had no clue that I was stuck. I guess they said, well, she's going to stay in that cage and just do the whole song from the cage. Meanwhile, somebody backstage, one of the stage crew guys, saw me. And they said, that's not a part of this show, because they had seen the rehearsal. So they got me out. So I've been stuck. I've been in all kinds of situations on stage. But so fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, just makes you laugh. Just laughing at everything that I've been through, that's funny. Just wonderful moments.
That's our guest today on Radio Time, singer, performer, Patti LaBelle. And she's just written a book with Laura Randolph about her life. It's called Don't Block the Blessings. Actually, let me just jump ahead before we take some calls here, because shortly after, I guess in the mid-70s, you went out on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what, LaBelle had sort of run its course, or we
all wanted to leave mm-hmm. each other. And we wanted to do it while we were in love. We didn't want to leave, like sometimes with a divorce, you leave on such ugly terms you never speak again. So, of course, we've had reunions. We've recorded twice together since the breakup. And the reason we broke up is because Nona wanted to do hard rock. I wanted to do more ballads, and Sarah wanted to do disco. So we couldn't do that together as LaBelle, as a unit. So we broke up.
Hmm.
And I was left to become a solo singer, not wanting to, but to get the courage, I saw a shrink for a few months to get my life together and my head together, and to think that when I got out there, I wouldn't be thrown eggs, because I said they're going to throw eggs at me because they're going to think it's my fault because I'm the lead singer.
Mm-hmm. And it's your fault that LaBelle broke up.
That we broke up, because lead singers want to go on their own. I didn't. But we went to London and did a performance as a solo performer, and I got a standing ovation that night, and from then on, I wasn't afraid any longer. Wow. So that's how I started singing solo.
Let's go to Denise, and Denise is calling us from Germantown.
Oh my God, hello.
Did we catch you off guard, Denise?
Listen, I got to hurry and get off the phone. My boss told me I couldn't get off.
Talk
but
fast.
But I want to tell you three things. One, you know that song that you did, A New Attitude?
Uh-huh.
That song was it meant a lot to me because it came out at a time when I was going through a spiritual and a life metamorphosis.
Oh, really?
And I used to sing that all the time.
That's
all day,
positive
night. People were so tired of hearing me.
Really?
Yeah, they said, well, you don't sound like her, so what are you singing for?
Oh, well, you sounded like yourself, and that was good enough.
That's right. That's what I said.
Yes.
I said, you know, my thing is everyone can sing. It's just
that's
that some
right,
people
Denise.
Sound better than others.
That's all?
And another thing was that another song I love.
I was going to say, you better talk quickly, Denise, before
no,
you don't get you in trouble.
The other line.
Okay, what?
I'm just so glad. Oh, God, my daughter loves you, too.
Thank you.
That's right. She's the only, you're the only person that I like that she likes.
Really? She probably saw me on Sesame Street.
Yes, she did. But she just likes your voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she sings your songs all the time.
Thank you, Denise.
You know, I'm trying to introduce her to Nina Simone, but she's not interested.
Oh, she
like
better
Patti
get
LaBelle and Tom Thurston.
Oh, Nina's a girl.
Huh?
That's a wonderful one to introduce her to, Nina Simone.
Yeah, I love her too.
Yes, so do I.
Oh, I gotta go.
Denise,
bye, honey,
bye.
Don't get fired.
Bye. Yeah, bye bye. Thanks a lot.
It's okay, bye.
Thanks a lot. See ya.
This thing is gonna be in trouble.
and we will get back to the phones in just a minute or two because there is a part of your life that which was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents' very violent divorce.
Yes.
The fact that as a little girl you write about being molested in a basement, a place that you would go to find some kind of comfort.
Yeah, it was my comfort zone.
And while you were down there, a man molested you. You also talk about your encounter with Jackie Wilson, where he assaulted you in a hallway.
In a hallway of a theater. He and an assistant of his pulled me into the room with Jackie Wilson, and they both tried to rape me. And my dress was half up and off, and I screamed as loud as I could, and it scared them. And so I got out, and I told my friends Sarah, Nona, and Cindy, and that those were the only people who knew about this secret. And, of course, he and his assistant knew, but we never confronted him. They wanted to go right away to him and just let him have it. And
right.
I said, no, it's
why,
embarrassing.
Why no?
It was embarrassing to me because it was a dirty act, and I felt dirty. And I didn't want our manager to know. I didn't feel as though it was my fault. I definitely didn't feel that. I felt dirty, and it was just like even being molested as a child by the family friend. I never wanted to talk to my mother or my sisters about it because it felt dirty. Mm-hmm. And my family and I, we never talked about sex or anything like that. If anybody came in a room and started talking about sex, I would walk out. Embarrassing. So I didn't think that my mother wouldn't believe me. I knew she would, but I said, I have to tell her about that filthy act. I don't think so.
Mm.
But I do say in the book that if you have gone through anything like that, you better talk about it. And talk about it now, because to hold it for 20 years the way I have, it doesn't make a healthy person.
Well, what impact do you think it has had on you to keep a secret like
that? It didn't diminish my love toward men. I didn't feel that all men were dogs. I just knew two were. And it just made me understand and realize that you can't trust everybody and you can't put people on pedestals. It's like Jackie Wilson. He was my hero. I still want to sing one of his songs. He's the best singer out there. And for him to do this to me just diminished my feelings toward him and said to myself, the lesson in that is you never place anyone like this on a level, on a platform, because they can fall and they can embarrass you. They can insult you. And disrespect you. So nobody should be placed there, you know, because you never know what they're going
to
do.
But you said you've always wanted to sing one of his songs.
I still do.
But you can't?
I can't. I just can't. Although I sing a song that Al Green does, and he's sort of like not one of my favorite people because of the way he treated me. But I put one of his songs in my show recently. So maybe at one point I will sing Jackie Wilson's song. Because I have forgiven these people. That's why the book is a call, Don't Block the Blessings. And the reason it's called that is because the hostility that I had been holding for them, I felt at a time it was time for me to let go and let God and get this negativity out of my life, because all of that energy was just eating me up. And that way I wasn't letting my blessings in. I was blocking them because negativity was the main thing in my focus and my aura was negative. And I let it go. And that's why maybe at this point I can sing Al Green's song.
Let me ask you something else in the book, and then we'll get right back to the phones.
Mm-hmm.
You also write about the fact that your sisters all died in their 40s. Your father died of Alzheimer's disease.
My father had Alzheimer's and prostate cancer. My mother died after both legs being amputated, died of diabetes. My sister Jackie had lung cancer My sister Vivian had lung and brain cancer. My sister Barbara had colon cancer. And my best friend before 44 died of breast cancer.
And you write that you never thought
you'd make it. I thought I would die before I turned 45. And then I made it to 45. And then it was a countdown to 50. I said, if I can make it to 50, I'll be here for a long, long time. And I'm 52 now. And feeling guilty, but feeling very wonderful that I have been spared.
Guilty because you've lived this long?
Because I lived this long. Yeah. And you know you have that feeling because you're saying, if they all died before 44, why am I still here? And then you realize the reason that you're still here. You're here to carry on a message and to not just sing to people, but if you can talk and say things that will help them go through their life a little differently than the way I did and not make the same mistakes I did, then it's in the book. And I tell you about how not to live as well as how to live. Because I know the movie. I wrote the script.
I understand. Let's go to Martha. And Martha's calling us from Center City, Philadelphia.
Hi. Well, first I'd like to say I think you're the best interviewer, Marty.
Oh, thank you.
In the world.
Oh, thank you. And, well, it's fun to have someone that's fun to talk to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Patti LaBelle is sitting across from me here.
Well, I'm nuts for singers and good singers. And well, I'm happy to say I think that you're a great Philadelphian, Patti.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you could comment on the record you made with Lauren Nero.
Yes.
Could you tell us about that session and how she picked the Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells to be on that record?
Actually, she was a fan for a long time, and I had no clue Lauren Nero knew who I was or the group because I loved her, always loved her.
Yeah.
And so she called the producers, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, and said that she wanted to record an album in Philadelphia, and she wanted to Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells to sing on it with her. And so, of course, we were honored, and we went there, and we recorded the Going to Take a Miracle album. And when we recorded it, after it was done, we realized it was so imperfect. But
imperfect.
Imperfect. It was so many mistakes, but after we listened, we said, but we love it like this.
Yeah.
Let's not fix it.
Because it's real?
Yeah, it was real and raw and right.
It's a wonderful record.
Oh, thank you so much, and I love her. And we're still friends. We communicate a lot.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's about it.
Thank you, Martha.
Bye.
Let's go to Rick, and Rick is calling us from Ben Salem.
Hello, Patti.
Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Fine, how are you?
I have a Patti LaBelle story from my early childhood.
Go for it, Rick. Go ahead.
Yes.
I grew up in Trenton. And my cousin, Brucie, used to go with Sarah. And I can remember the three of you coming over my aunt's house, and I guess my older cousins had to take me to the show that you guys were having, and you sang at a skating rink.
Right.
In Trenton.
And
it was the first time I had heard you sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I was a 7-year-old kid, and I had heard Judy Garland's version. But then just hearing your version blew me away.
Really?
So now, years later, I moved to Boston. And when I was in Boston with my cousin Vincent, I would always talk about how strong your voice was, how good a singer you were. And everybody was like, oh, that old song? Sold My Heart to the Junkman. I said, no, you have to hear her sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And years later, once you went through LaBelle and then you came out single, people start to hearing you, really hearing you. And everybody that I talk to then agrees with me that Patti LaBelle is one of the best singers out there.
Oh, thank you so much.
I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
I really appreciate that. Honest, I do.
Okay, take care now.
Oh, thanks a lot, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling in.
I appreciate that.
I know you sang for the president for his 48th birthday the White House, and you really cut loose there, didn't you?
I cut loose. I said to my husband before I went out, he said, now you're going to not roll tonight, right?
And
you're not going to kick off your shoes.
Okay,
I'll explain. We were doing a 48th birthday for the president, and before the singing of Happy Birthday, I did a 30-minute show. And my husband is like a cop, and so much not like me. He's like Sunday morning and I'm Saturday night. And I'm very wild and outgoing and he's very laid back and conservative. And so he never wants me to roll on the stage, period, or kick off my shoes. So he said, I know you're not going to do it tonight for all those folks out there and the president. I said, the president wanted Patti LaBelle, nobody else. I said, if he wanted somebody else, he would have called them. I said, so of course I'm going to do what feels good. I rolled and I broke my dress. The zip just totally came open. And it was funny though. I laughed at it. And when they came up for me to sing, Hillary said, you are so good and so funny. I said, if only you knew how funny I was. I said, feel the back of my dress. And I had a jacket on over the zip. And she said, your behind is out. So I said, yes, it is. And it was out. The zipper had broken. But that's from being a crazy lady and rolling on stage. But I love to perform and I love to be myself. I can't pretend. to be anybody else.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patti LaBelle, for joining
us
today on Radio Time.
This was so nice, and you are one of the best interviewers around.
Well, thank you very
much. You are. The lady
coming
was
from
so
you,
right.
I appreciate that.
Oh, no, your spirit is so nice and calming.
Someday I wish upon a star can wake up where the clouds are far behind.
That was Philly-born music sensation Patti LaBelle singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow from her Grammy-winning 1998 live album recorded at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. In the years after our 1996 interview, the godmother of soul has gone on to have continued success in her second act, including as a best-selling cookbook author. Joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCory, and he is helping me sort through the archives to make the Radio Times Rewind series. Kevin, always fun to talk to you about some of these old interviews.
Oh my goodness. You and Patti seem like you had a blast in that interview.
You know, I have to say, what a thrill it was to have Patti LaBelle in studio, which it was. And I was a little nervous, and she was so much fun to talk to and so easy to talk to. I literally felt like we were just sitting over our kitchen table having a conversation. And I will say that the producers were very angry at me because we had music queued up. And I just said, I just want to talk to this woman, even though it's kind of silly not to play her music.
And you think of Patti LaBelle as a diva, but she did not seem like a diva at all. She seemed just like Patti from the block in Philly.
Yeah. I mean, again... You meet someone for an hour. I'm no expert on who they actually are. But in terms of what she delivered to our listeners that day, it was really special. And I don't think she had this giant entourage of people. I think it was maybe Patti and maybe one other person that came and brought her to the station. So a thrill, to say the least.
What jumped out to you in terms of like what she said in her story and what she talked about?
Well, I love all the Philly references. And you know, I'm sort of the same age as Patti, so I certainly remember those girl groups from the 1950s into the 1960s. She was so much a part of the 60s. And just how cool it was to listen to them. I mean, I would hold my hairbrush and pretend like I was, you know, one of the singers as we did back then, looking into the mirror and trying to be cool like them. But those songs are just so catchy. They're so well done, so much energy, so fun.
And she talked about, I guess, growing up in Southwest Philly and being super shy, which was kind of surprising. If you see her stage persona, you would never think that.
No.
But I guess that was something she had to overcome.
Yeah, but, you know, I've interviewed a number of actors, not all of them, but a number of them will talk about their shyness. And it isn't just overcoming it. It's almost like they become another person when they're performing. And I don't know if that's true for her, but it's not as unusual as you would think, even though you think, look at the way she performs. She does not look like someone who is shy.
Right. And she even, I guess, to that day was like, there's a different Patti LaBelle in my house versus the one that goes outside my house. And she talks about performing at the White House for Bill Clinton in 1994, I believe it was, for his 48th birthday.
Can you imagine?
And her husband's like, don't roll around and make a fool of yourself. And she's like, well, they hired Patti LaBelle, so I'm going to be Patti LaBelle.
Exactly. Well, that sort of speaks to this. It's not like a multiple personality thing, but it's just there's a public persona and a private persona. It has to be something like that. You know, I Googled her to see sort of what is she up to today. She's got a big touring schedule in the fall, so she's back at it, or she's at it and going strong.
Yeah, really. And I was surprised about the whole like cookbook life. Like she's become this like kind of, you know, a figure in that world, and like, you know, sells soul food cookbooks and has her own line of sheets and things like that. Like really an entrepreneur who has found success in multiple levels and ways. And here she is like still thriving in 2025. It's wild.
You know, I went back and listened to some of her hit songs. And Lady Marmalade is so good.
Yeah.
That's LaBelle, of course, but it's just so good. And the performances are just, takes you back to a certain time and place. Stay with Radio Times Rewind. In just a moment, we'll be back with my 2013 interview with jazz guitarist Kevin Eubanks and what he regrets about his time as the band leader for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. This is Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Coane. Next up is my 2013 interview with Philadelphia-born jazz guitarist Kevin Eubanks. We begin with how he got his start in music, which included training at Settlement Music School.
When I started playing violin, it was really because my mother used to teach piano lessons on weekends. So every weekend we'd hear Bach two-part inventions or, you know, whatever she was teaching. And she had a student named Julia Cawley. And she and I was just infatuated with Julia, you know. Oh, Julia's coming this weekend for a piano lesson. Oh, I get to, you know, I was all of, what, 7, 8 years old, right? So, but everybody had to wait in the living room, and when their lesson time came, they'd go down in the basement and take piano lessons, you know. So I always wait because I was so shy, I couldn't really, you know.
Was like, she beautiful?
Talk to her.
She
was gorgeous, right?
Yeah, okay.
You know, what do I know? So she goes down and takes her lessons, but then she would always carry this case, and I thought it was a violin. So while she was downstairs, I, you know, being a curious kid, wanted to see what was in the case. So I opened it up, and there's this beautiful instrument, and I thought it was a violin. It actually was a viola. And so from that day, I said, Ma, I want to play violin. And she said, you don't want to play violin. You don't know what you're talking about.
You just like her,
yeah,
right?
You know. And I said, no, I'm not really going to play violin. I said, okay, we're going to give you violin lessons. You better, you know.
It's hard, right?
So you have to have a patient family to have a violinist at 7 or 8 years old. I mean,
it doesn't sound so good.
Torture for everybody, you know. So that's why I started playing violin, and I played it for about 7 years until I kind of switched to guitar, which is one of the most regrettable things musically, is that I stopped playing violin when I started playing guitar. I should have just continued to play violin along with guitar. But I was having so much more fun playing guitar because of the nature of playing music in Philly in those days. Everybody played in a band. It was just so much more social, more exciting, and, you know, just basically more fun than going to all-city rehearsals and things like that, or playing in district orchestras and stuff like that. But one of the regrets I have in life was that I stopped playing violin. Mm. And the other one is that I should be a piano player, violinist, and guitarist.
Well, there's still time, right?
Well, yeah, I like playing piano just for fun, which is great to have something that you don't necessarily, quote-unquote, have to be good at. You just can kind of relax. It's kind of like a hobby.
And how did your parents or your mother, how did they feel about you playing guitar? Was that okay? Was that a...
That was okay until I quit violin. And then it was one of those, you know, pivotal moments when you become, you know, mark your years as a teenager, rebellious, not doing the common sense thing. And that was it, you know. Everybody remembers when I quit. That was traumatic for me at the, you know, because my parents thought that I might be a quitter as a character trait. So that was... And I did other things that, you know, supported that idea. It wasn't just that. So
whether there was a pattern developing.
Yeah,
here
there was like there were other things, you know, I can't, you know, just say they just, you know, that was the only factor. But it turns out that I wasn't really quitting anything. It was always connected. So, well, I'm not playing violin, but I didn't quit music. Now I'm playing guitar all day and all night. And, you know, everything had – there was a certain madness to what I was doing, though I was unaware of it.
Sure. Was the Philly music scene or even jazz scene that much different, you think?
Yeah, it's a big difference. When I was coming up, all we did was play gigs. I was playing in – I remember my mom and dad arguing over – whether to let me play in bars when I was 13 years old, because my dad was a policeman. And he didn't, well, maybe he was a detective by then, Ghost Hill detective by that time.
For the Philly Police Department?
Oh, yeah. And I was 13. I'd only been playing guitar for about a year, so I probably sounded awful. And but people were asking me to play gigs, and they were at bars, basically. Now they call them clubs. Some of them. and then my father said, well, he's not playing at a bar at 13 years old. And my mom said, well, they said if there's an adult there that he could play. So the keyboard player's mom would go to all the gigs, and we would just destroy her car by putting all our equipment in her car. She was,
that's a good mom.
Yeah. And so as long as she was there, he said, okay. So that started me... But that's at 13, and when you're 13, and you're playing, you know, just cover songs, Sly and Family Stone at the time, or Earth, Wind, and Fire, or whoever, and you get $20, $25, $30, and you're 13 years old, all you want to do is go to the record store, buy more records, buy guitar strings, you know, buy some spray paint. I spray painted my guitar because I wanted a racing stripe over it, and, you know, all kinds of silly stuff like that, but you could go buy the paint. I mean, it was just... Yeah. And then as you grow older, you did weddings, you did, they called them cabarets back then and the whole thing. And it got to the point where it was like, this is how intense it was playing in bands when I was coming up, 13 through 16, 17 years old. Am I going to stay in Philly and play with the band or go to college? And this seems like how could that even be a question? But at the time, it was critical. I couldn't sleep. Like, wow. Am I going to quit?
And that was
a
real choice for you, right?
It was a real choice, but I got kicked out of the band, so it was all right.
I'm curious what you learned from the Tonight Show. How many? 18 years? 15 mm-hmm. years?
18 years.
18 years playing, mm-hmm. and a number of those years as a musical director.
Yeah.
What did you learn about music or being a live band?
Well, one thing I learned is playing with so many different people that came on, from Dolly Parton to B.B. King to... you know, Clint Black, whoever, there's just so many people that I got to meet them, albeit for a small amount of time, but over the years you see them more and more and more, that once you, like Willie Nelson is a, you know, a perfect example. Once I got to meet Willie and hang out with Willie, go on his bus with him, hang out, know the people that his, you know, his bus driver Gates and everybody. Once you know the person and you like the person, you want to like what they do.
Right.
So there's no, it cuts through the thing of it being different music because it's a person you meet first. So it's not this genre of music or that genre of music. It's like, well, I just like the cat. We have a good time hanging out. So then whatever he does, you see it related to a person, not a musical taste. So it's easier to like what somebody else is doing, which basically means you can get in, you're more open to somebody's ideas once you get to know them.
Right.
If I meet you and I like you and you like me, then, well, his idea must be okay or something, you know, worth me giving some energy to because it's come from this person who I like. So it kind of helped me cut through a lot of judgment about music and about a lot of things and about Hollywood itself. You just have a pervasive learning curve if you're open to it there. I mean, I can't really go through all of it other than to say that I got thrown into something I knew nothing about and came out with a great appreciation for all the things I learned there.
And it's, I mean, you spend a lot of time doing that. You sort of completed the process. So
yeah.
No regrets, no looking back, no
The only regret that I might have is that I may have been able to use the position, been a little bit more proactive in some of the things that I could have been a bit more influential about. But I was so busy trying to, you know, do some gigs, do records, and do that at the same time, that I didn't really understand that, oh, man, I could have pushed this agenda a little bit more or networked with some people that had a common purpose and done more with it.
I actually want to go back to your album, Kevin, and play a piece of Resolution from, actually written by John Coltrane, another Philadelphia musician, of course.
Yeah,
do you think there's a Philly sound when it comes to jazz?
Yeah, there's a Philly sound when it comes to music, not just jazz, but funk, R&B, hip-hop, whatever. I mean, Philly is just a musical town. I mean, you know, the musical bloodlines in Philly are just part of, you know, just part of Philadelphia. Like I was saying earlier, before we were coming in, I just came back from a pretty long tour in Europe, and it doesn't surprise me anymore. I could be in the northern part of Sweden or somewhere in Germany, somewhere in the Czech Republic or wherever, and it doesn't surprise me anymore when I meet people there that are musicians from Philadelphia, and they live there, they're working there, they're part of the music scene there and the whole thing. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, you can go how many decades, no matter how far you go back, Philly's just musically strong.
I do want to squeeze this in just before we have to say goodbye, and this is a Resolution written by John Coltrane from Love Supreme, from Kevin Eubanks' new album, The Messenger. I read that you're pescatarian, meaning you're a fish eater?
No, I'm vegan.
Oh, you're vegan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes even more sense. In 2007, PETA said you're the world's sexiest vegetarian man.
Yeah, I was shocked too. You guys got to write, you know. And like I was saying earlier, if I'd have been a little bit more aware, I could have used that platform to, you know, speak more about, you know, what it means to be vegan and encourage people to read Dr. Campbell's book or Joel Fuhrman's, you know, books and things like that, so people can be more aware of, you know, qualities of the food they eat and things like that without it being, you know, a drag.
Yeah,
you know
sort
what
of
I mean?
Finger wagging, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
That was my 2013 interview with Kevin Eubanks. Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series on Sunday evenings. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. Next Sunday, famed novelist Salman Rushdie. Does anything offend you?
Oh, lots of things offend me. You know, the novels of Dan Brown. but I think he should probably live.
And that's the difference, right?
That's the difference, yeah.